Chapter 11 Hiring 'em and Keeping 'em. Engagement in a Digital World. Shakespeare's Richard III proclaimed, "Off with his head," with casual abandon, and Donald Trump expanded his brand awareness via his TV show The Apprentice with his almost joyful proclamations of, "You're fired." For my own part, letting people go has never made me anything but extremely sad. I almost always feel that firings are much more of an indictment on the company's failure than that of the employee, no matter what the circumstances behind it might be. On the other hand, I always derive great pleasure from telling someone, "You're hired." Why hiring should be your number one priority. Whether you're planning a startup, preparing to relaunch, or expanding your business, it's often hard to know which tasks to delegate, which to delay, and which to tackle right away. In my experience, if there is one area in which you should definitely become immersed and do a lot of the work yourself, it is the hiring process. As much as I believe in delegation, putting your imprimatur on the key management is something you have to do. Remember that these are the people to whom you are going to be delegating a lot of important decisions, and quickly, so they'd better be people with whom you feel 100% comfortable. And if you're reading this and thinking that your company is just too big already, and you are way too important and busy to involve yourself with something as mundane as the hiring of staff, that's what we have a people department for, isn't it? Then maybe you should think again. I have always insisted on being involved with senior-level hiring decisions in all of our companies, even if it sometimes means flying the applicants all the way to Necker Island to spend time with me, something about which I have received very few complaints. Even at Google, a $400 billion company which is still hiring at a rate of over 4,000 people a year, founder and CEO Larry Page still insists on being the final arbiter on whether or not to make a job offer to anyone being considered for a leadership role within the company. I know firsthand how this critical approach has paid off around the Virgin Group, and I know from personal conversations with Larry that he sees his involvement in the hiring process not as some symbolic role that he has to make time for, but rather as one of the most important parts of his job. As I am sure Larry Page and his partner Sergey Brin will vividly recall, given that Google was incorporated as recently as 1998, the founders of a company inevitably must wear many very different hats during the first few crazy years. In Virgin's case, a mere 30 years or so before Google, I handled everything from the secretarial work to, scarily, the company accounts at our first businesses. Like all young entrepreneurs, however, my first big business lesson was that you have simply got to delegate your duties if you want your venture to survive, and, ideally, grow. It is almost impossibly hard to acknowledge this in the early going, but you should also be hiring with a weather eye on the day when you're going to delegate even your CEO position and step back from the business's day-to-day operations and focus on ensuring that your company is prepared for what's next. Sarah Blakely once told me, "The smartest thing I ever did in the early going was to hire my weaknesses." That unusually early level of self-awareness and smarts may be one of the biggest contributing factors to how Sarah has managed to build a billion-dollar business from the ground up in just a dozen or so years. In my case, I think it was in large part down to my dyslexia that I learned very early on in my career that I needed to become comfortable with the art of delegation. As I had already realized in my aborted school career, there were just some tasks with which I really struggled, For example, whether it's called mathematics or accounting, numbers were just not my forte. We hired an accountant early on. As we grew and I delegated further, I still felt I had the knowledge base to be comfortable getting involved in almost all the major decision-making processes. As soon as we stepped outside of the entertainment field, however, that was most decidedly no longer the case, something I quickly discovered when I unilaterally decided it was time for us to take the hugely tangential leap into commercial aviation. Plain sailing. When we were getting ready to launch Virgin Atlantic, and with zero experience whatsoever in the airline industry, I realized how important the ability to delegate was going to be. With a helping hand from Sir Freddie Laker and others, we were soon able to assemble a team of very smart and highly qualified aviation experts to blend with our experienced Virgin business managers. Roy Gardner, who became our first managing director, and David Tate, who ran the US side of the business, were two of the first people we grabbed, both having formerly worked closely with Sir Freddie at Laker Airways. I soon got the feeling that Roy and David were used to having a boss who knew the airline business inside out, so I think they quite enjoyed working with someone new to aviation who was prepared to delegate most of the decision-making to them. For a new company, it was almost like managing a merger, and the blending of our existing Virgin Group music industry people with the newly hired career airline people certainly made for an extremely interesting chemistry experiment. A lot of the time, we never quite knew how the laid-back Virgin attitude of, "Hey, don't sweat it, rules are made to be broken," was going to react when mixed with the more by-the-book and rigid disciplines of the airline industry. We obviously couldn't tell an engineer to try plugging his gizmos in somewhere else just to see what happened, but we could suggest that maybe we should try using the famous French restaurateur Maximes of Paris with butlers in tailcoats to serve our upper-class section. Sadly, it didn't last more than a few weeks. The fancy French sauces that worked in a kitchen at sea level just didn't hold together at 35,000 feet. And worse still, those tails kept tripping the butlers up as they climbed the circular staircase to our Boeing 747's upper deck. But it certainly got us lots of press, and, as with all attempts to effect real change, if we'd never tried it, we'd never have known. It was a tribute to the people on both sides of the equation that, surprisingly perhaps, we never had any violent eruptions, and the two groups quickly came together with a healthy balance and understanding as to which elements the other needed to function and where there were grounds for serious further experimentation. Together, in an unprecedented period of just 5 months, the team not only got a brand new transatlantic airline off the ground, literally, but in the process they succeeded in creating and delivering the level of service that I had hoped for and that a lot of newly acquired passengers would appreciate for many years to come. Had I not been willing and able to step back and let them get on with it, the outcome could have been very different. Hiring the right people is a skill, and like most things, you get better at it with practice. But there are some good shortcuts that can help you learn quickly. Here are my tips for identifying great people and building your team. Characters and cultures. Although almost certainly not involved in hiring people, the 19th century American essayist Ralph Waldo Emerson once wrote that character is higher than intellect. I am sure it will come as no surprise that I wholeheartedly endorse this line of thought, although the task of uncovering the true character of a job candidate can be a challenge. Essentially, an interview is a game of figuring out whether or not the character of a candidate will be a good fit with the culture of the company. One great way to test this may be to ask two or three of the employees who will work with this person to join you at some point in the interview, and to come prepared with a few of their own questions. When your employees start talking to the candidate, it's time for you to listen and observe, not just what is said, but any telltale body language signs that might indicate that what they're saying and what they're thinking might not be the same thing. How is everyone getting along? While a little awkwardness and nervousness has to be expected, look for someone with a sense of humor, who is fun, friendly, and caring, because that is a person who likely understands teamwork and will help others. If they are clearly suffering from an extreme case of the interview jitters, I have often broken the ice by asking them to tell me a joke. It's amazing how telling a joke, even if doing it really badly, can make someone laugh at themselves and come out of their shell. In fact, as one of the world's worst tellers of jokes, I relate really well to the ones who get stuck after, "Did you hear the one about..." In the US, our hotel team has been doing some innovative things on the hiring front as we gear up for the late 2014 opening of the first property in Chicago. Rather than just wading through hundreds, if not thousands, of job seeker applications, we have been creating a local buzz via social media and conducting hiring roadshows. The plan is to touch audiences that aren't necessarily looking to change jobs and grab their attention with what looks like an interesting new career path in a really cool work environment. At our group interviews, applicants may find themselves playing Twister with potential co-workers, or role-playing things like taking an 85-year-old guest to her room. The idea being to let applicants' personalities shine through in simulated real-life situations. We want people who can laugh and have fun with our guests, which is not something you can easily discover by reading a CV and asking questions over an interview desk. A CV is just a piece of paper. Obviously, a good CV is important, but if you were going to hire by what they say about themselves on paper, you wouldn't need to waste time on an interview. One good question to ask a candidate is what he or she didn't include. I have always valued capability over expertise. While you may need to hire specialists for some positions, take a close look at people who have thrived in different industries and jobs. They are usually more versatile, have transferable skills, and can potentially tackle problems creatively. The would-be expert who has been stuck in a groove somewhere else for years is much more likely to simply replicate their past, almost muscle memory-like approach to the job. Obviously, a healthy mix of experience and novel thinking is the ideal, but on balance, I would anticipate more fresh and objective solutions to flow from the smart and curious inexpert outsider than the been-there-done-that experts. Also, don't jump to the conclusion that someone who has worked for five different companies in the last 5 years cannot hold down a job. It could just be that the job couldn't hold them. Be forthright and ask pointed questions like what it is they are seeking and why you should hire them if they're only going to be around for a year. Rather than being just another stepping stone along their way, can you perhaps give them what they are looking for in a mutually appealing destination? Above all, don't get hung up on qualifications alone. A person who has multiple degrees in your field isn't always better than someone who has broad experience and a great personality. By the same token, the expression that someone is overqualified for the job is utterly nonsensical. If they feel they want a change of pace or a new direction, then more power to them. Take chances on people. I have always been a great believer in trusting your instincts when interviewing people. First impressions shouldn't rule the day, but remember that the initial reaction you have when meeting an interviewee is presumably based on the best impression they can create. So if at first sight your gut screams, "You've got to be joking," then think how they will come across when they're not trying so hard. And would you want this person walking into a room as your representative? On the other hand, I have also found that some people can seem like oddballs at first sight, but then turn out to be indispensable. A maverick who sees off-the-wall opportunities where others see nothing but problems can energize your entire group. So, even if their CV may not be quite right, he or she may be a little different than everyone else on your team, this might be a good time to take a risk and hire them anyway. Whenever possible, promote from within. If you've been hiring great people all along, when an executive or manager does leave, you should look long and hard at filling that job from within, if at all possible. If, however, as can sometimes be the case with the most senior jobs, you do not have a candidate who is quite ready or a perfect fit, then don't make the mistake of moving someone into the role just because it's their turn. And even when you do seem to have a prime candidate in-house, it never hurts to advertise the job and see what is available on the open market. Your inside candidate can suddenly look very different when seen in the context of someone else whom you never thought would be available or interested in working for you. When you can promote from within, however, it certainly sends a great message to everyone in the company that when someone demonstrates a passion for the job and leadership skills at every step along the way, then the sky's the limit. We have countless great success stories all across the group of people starting in entry-level jobs, making it into senior management. For example, Chris Rossi, who is now Virgin Atlantic's Senior Vice President in the USA, started out working behind the check-in counter when we first began flying to Boston in 1991. Chris next moved into the local sales team, eventually making it to VP Sales before becoming our senior person in the US. At Virgin Active in South Africa, Kiki Baloyi began her career in 2003 as a receptionist. She had trained in sports management but couldn't find a position in that field. As the first team member that Active members met on entering the club, Kiki's people skills shone through and quickly earned her a promotion to fitness instructor, where she demonstrated her commitment to not just improving members' fitness, but also to building their motivation levels. In the last 7 years, Kiki has been promoted several times, and in 2013 was named the Assistant General Manager of our new Alice Lane Health Club. Recognizing the potential Chris and Kiki's at the interview stage takes time and a healthy dose of curiosity. You need to meet a lot of people, ask them about themselves and their careers, and tell them about yourself and your company in turn. So relax and be yourself. The people you eventually choose are, after all, going to play big parts in your shared adventure of building a business. As important as it is to look at what a candidate has achieved elsewhere, I have always believed that the single most important thing to consider is personality fit. By that I mean, is this someone whose way of being, sense of humor, and general demeanor will dovetail easily with your company's culture? Ramming a square peg into a round hole may work well for carpenters, but it seldom works with people. While the majority of skills can be learned, when it comes to personality, what you see tends to be what you get. With the caveat, of course, that what you'll see on a best behavior interview showing is not always what you'll get when they're installed on the payroll. You can never tell. Just as it takes many different types of CEOs and top managers to lead Virgin's 50,000 plus employees and keep our businesses purposeful and profitable, you can never tell where your next leaders are going to come from. We find great leaders everywhere, some working hard inside our companies, others working for large competitors, or sometimes they just walk in on us right out of the blue. Such was the case when Matthew Bucknell and Frank Reed arrived in my Holland Park office in 1997. The two of them had just sold their own fitness club, Living Well, and were looking to do it all over again, but better, and this time with the Virgin brand as a key part of their plan. I talk elsewhere about the value of short presentations. Well, their business plan for Virgin Active was about the most concise I have ever seen. It simply read, "We want to create the first global comprehensive consumer-led branded health and fitness facility, readily accessible to a wide socio-demographic group at a price consumers are willing and able to pay." I liked the idea right off the bat. Health clubs that would be fun, innovative, and inclusive, rather than exclusive, and represent true value for money while enriching the lives of members. What was not to like about such a vision? When they then added the promise that they would turn Virgin Active into our ninth billion-dollar business, what could I say other than, screw it, let's get active and do it? I dispatched the two of them with the simple brief to go out and take a year to look at what was happening in the sector all around the world, and then come back and make their dream a reality. In 1998, the first club opened in the perhaps unlikely location of Preston, Lancashire, and we were on our way. By 2012, they had not only fulfilled their ambition of producing the world's finest health and fitness clubs, but had also reached the promised $1 billion in revenue. As of last count, Virgin Active had almost 300 global clubs, around 1.25 million members, and is still actively expanding into new markets. As an example of homegrown leaders, there's the now husband and wife team of Lisa and Kenton, Kenny Jones. Lisa started out as an in-flight beauty therapist on Virgin Atlantic before coming to Necker Island to work as a spa therapist, while Kenny began as a junior water sports instructor on the island. While working together, the two of them managed to find the time to fall in love, and as a couple became an even stronger team, with Kenny moving up to activities director and Lisa to front of house manager, where both became hugely popular with all of the island's, sometimes quite demanding, guests. Their next stop was to spend 2 years in the Casbah, as general managers of Necker's sister property, Casbah Tamadot, in Morocco, where their continued success set them up for a return to the Virgin Islands, this time running the whole show as Necker's general managers. They also now have two beautiful island children running around, Theo and Zara. Lisa and Kenny live and breathe the Virgin way. They both possess a seemingly never-ending supply of the magical ingredients that has always worked so well for Virgin: a youthful joie de vivre and great people skills, combined with a relentless focus on great service and succeeding at each and every task they take on. Oh yes, and lest I forget, their never-failing sense of humor is especially important when you have a nitpicky boss, that would be me, who not only works but also lives on your patch. While Kenny and Lisa grew up in-house with Virgin Limited Edition, by contrast, some of our leaders have come to us from some pretty huge competitors. David Cush was an executive at American Airlines for more than 22 years before joining Virgin America, where he really took to heart the opportunity to work in a smaller company where every voice could be heard. David pioneered the airline's Refresh training program, which brings employees back to the San Francisco headquarters for an annual 2-day session to share their experiences in maintaining the best customer service in the skies. And if my last visit to one was anything to go by, to party up a storm. Attended by every employee, senior management included, the refresher course emphasizes communication, recognition, and teamwork. David joins in as often as he can, and recently sat in on a session where teammates brainstorms improvements to the, always a sensitive area, staff travel policy. He then made sure that the group's best suggestion was implemented, delighting all who'd contributed. David's leadership has turned the first U.S. domestic airline to start up after 9/11 into a critically acclaimed, award-winning, and profitable business. Let my people go. As I said right up front, we all tend to be products of our upbringing, our home, and for many, our work environments. So when you're interviewing someone who might have been working for years in a straitjacketed, by-the-book, authoritative environment, IBM used to be the favorite example for such regimes, it is important to remember that it can have its pros and cons. Let me explain what I mean. I have always liked to compare the workplace environment at each of the Virgin companies to being like open zoos. This is not meant to conjure up an image of wild animals scaring the visitors, but more a place that, though still with perimeters, is totally devoid of cages. Most tradition-bound large corporate environments feature a lot of cage dwellers. The higher up the pecking order you go, the bigger the cage, and vice versa. Unlike zoo cages, however, which are to lock the occupant in, the corporate versions tend much more to be used to keep people out, where a perpetually closed door sends a clear "do not disturb" message, and an open door means out to lunch. At the interview stage, candidates coming out of caged environments will predictably find the prospect of moving into a free-ranging, open zoo tremendously appealing. They will usually be quick to point out how their entrepreneurial zeal and creativity was never able to truly take flight within their current or previous employer's tight parameters. And while they probably mean every word of it, there is one inherent danger that you must really dig into before you get swept away by their overtures of "set me free and watch me soar." This not insignificant issue is, you can take the person out of the cage, but can you take the cage out of the person? As much as long-time caged executives can crave their freedom, when suddenly stripped of the security that the cage also afforded, some simply cannot handle it. And when that happens, the first thing they will start to do is to quietly begin building cages in their new workplace. At first, as maybe just a place to run and hide from the unfamiliar and threatening wide open spaces. But over time, there is a clear danger of proliferation. So, how does one go about the task of separating those who can adjust to and thrive in your culture from those who may never be able to shrug off their old hierarchical habits? In my experience, the key is focusing on personality rather than anything that you might see in their CV. It is not something that always comes out in interview. People can be shy. But you have to trust your own judgment. If you're confronted with a slightly introverted person, but you detect a great underlying personality, use your own personality and experience to pull it out of them. For a few moments, try and find some non-business common ground to discuss, which may be kids or sports, anything that's going to loosen them up. It is easier with an extrovert, but be wary of people becoming overexcited in the pressure cooker of an interview. It's very much the same thing as in school, where certain kids that perform really well in class can be utterly incapable of doing the same thing in a written test. So too, some people just don't interview well, because of a hugely complex mix of emotions, anxiety, and often just trying too hard in a way that masks the real them. Once you are comfortable with the personality fit, then delve into their experience and expertise and ask them to take you through some of the highlights. If it's a marketing job and they say they headed up a hugely successful campaign at their last job, don't just nod approvingly. Ask them to tell you about the strategy behind it and why it worked. Then ask them about some of the ones that never made it off the drawing board or that didn't work out as well as planned, and why. If you hire the wrong person at the top of a company, they can destroy it in no time at all. The same applies equally to external and internal appointments. So if the company is flourishing and the outgoing CEO has it firing on all cylinders, then maintaining that kind of status quo with an internal hire may be the smartest move, assuming there is a natural successor. If, on the other hand, the company is just plodding along and has done nothing particularly special for some time, you might want to make a point of looking outside to see what fresh thinking you may be able to find. Letting your internal candidates get an early sneak peek at the official headhunter job spec doesn't do any harm either. Their input on any requirements and qualities the spec is missing, or that are understated, will tell you a lot about their readiness to assume the role. Questions like, "So do you think we got it right? Is this really the kind of person we need in this job?" can lead to some very interesting places. Quantity often conflicts with quality, and it's no different when it comes to hiring standards. When companies go through growth spurts, they often hire in bulk, and such massive influxes can put a real strain on the company's culture. While it may seem necessary to get new bodies through the door as quickly as possible to help share the expansion-generated load, it is always worth being patient. A hasty hiring is seldom a good one, and the wrong person being thrust into your team can be very damaging. And if it means you have to operate shorthanded for a spell, so be it. So when you've got them, how do you keep them? I am sure there have been thousands of books written on the subject of employee retention, so I am not going to bore you with what I suspect you know already. It is perhaps worth mentioning, however, the reasons why people typically quit their jobs. In a huge leadership study dubbed Project Oxygen, Google recently found that the three principal reasons were: 1. They didn't feel enough of a connection to the company's mission, and/or their individual contribution was not considered important. 2. They didn't get along with or respect their co-workers. 3. They thought they had a terrible boss. Conspicuous by its absence is not being paid enough, so often considered the biggest reason people move on. All three of these issues are very tightly interwoven. For instance, bosses have bosses too, so the terrible boss in item 3 might also be suffering from a terrible boss who doesn't appreciate their contributions. Similarly, the failure to get along with colleagues can also be a symptom of a non-inclusive culture, or what I'd call a lack of engagement. Busy doesn't mean engaged. A lot of companies make the mistake of failing to understand the difference between keeping their people busy and keeping them engaged. I was always a fan of the I Love Lucy shows with Lucille Ball. There was one hilarious episode in which Lucy and her friend Ethel were making a futile attempt to wrap chocolates on a fast-moving production line. The resulting hilarious chaos was assuredly busy, but certainly had nothing to do with engagement. In real life, many an employee has mastered the art of appearing to be perpetually busy, but it is no metric to judge either their productivity or their true engagement level, if any. Similarly, employees who consistently work 12-hour days, often to mimic the behavior and hours of their bosses, don't necessarily demonstrate any real level of engagement. It's more a sign that the boss is not managing his, her own time terribly well, and is also blind to how it is affecting the lives of their staff. Such patterns, if sustained for any length of time, will usually become not only counterproductive, but will also result in burned out, disaffected, and unhappy employees. As my father used to say, it's not the hours you put in that matter, it's what you put into the hours. And when engagement levels drop, it's not only productivity that goes south. Customer service will inevitably also decline. The only things that increase are absenteeism and, off the back of it, turnover. So, what does it take to generate a healthy level of engagement? In my opinion, it comes down to strong leadership and developing a culture in which your employees feel valued, empowered, and trusted. All three of these things take time and work and require a lot of listening and dialogue. Leaders who have the ability to demonstrate genuine interest in their employees' interests, goals, and objectives, and let them air their opinions, will build the kind of levels of trust and confidence that, over time, translate to real engagement. And engagement is very much a two-way street in terms of both personal and corporate upsides. One study done by Towers Watson, the international professional services firm, showed that companies with the highest levels of employee engagement averaged operating margins of around 27%. Meanwhile, those at the bottom end of the engagement scale were producing margins below 10%. As an integral part of the same equation, the study concluded that at the disengaged companies, almost 40% of employees were likely to quit their jobs in the next 24 months, while at those companies with the highest engagement levels, that number dropped by more than half, to around 18%. If those numbers don't get you engaged, they should do. Change the policy to no policy. I wrote in Chapter 3 about how one very ill-advised marketing decision seriously damaged video rental firm Netflix and decimated their stock almost overnight. Happily, they recovered from it, got back on track, vanquished their one-time giant rival Blockbuster, and are now once again flying high as the runaway market leader in the streaming video sector. One clue as to how they intend to remain there this time comes from a very well-advised and downright courageous initiative they adopted that rewrote the book, or to be more precise, threw it away, on something very near and dear to the hearts of most workers around the world, their annual vacation day entitlement. I first learned of what Netflix was up to when my daughter Holly read a Daily Telegraph article and immediately forwarded the piece to me with a clearly excited email saying, "Dad, check this out. It's something I have been talking about for a while, and I believe it would be a very virgin thing to do to not track people's holidays." She then went on to say, I have a friend whose company has done the same thing, and they've apparently experienced a marked upward spike in everything. Morale, creativity, and productivity have all gone through the roof. Needless to say, I was instantly intrigued and wanted to learn more. The Telegraph article talked about the new vacation policy that has been adopted by Netflix, which might actually be more accurately described as being, well, no policy. It's a little bit like when you read that someone is offering a 0% interest rate. If there's no interest, can it really be called an interest rate? Anyway, simply stated, the policy that isn't permits all salaried staff to take off whenever they want for as long as they want. There is no need to ask for prior approval, and neither the employees themselves nor their managers are asked or expected to keep track of their days away from the office. It is left to the employee alone to decide if and when he or she feels like taking a few hours, a day, a week, or a month off. The assumption being that they are only going to do it when they feel 100% comfortable that they and their team are up to date on every project and that their absence will not in any way damage the business, or, for that matter, their careers. The Netflix initiative had been driven by a growing groundswell of employees asking about how their new technology-controlled time on the job, working at all kinds of hours, at home, and or everywhere they receive a business text or email, could be reconciled with the company's old-fashioned time-off policy. That is to say, if Netflix was no longer able to accurately track employees' total time on the job, why should it apply a different and outmoded standard to their time away from it? The company agreed, and as its reference guide on our freedom and responsibility culture explains, we should focus on what people get done, not on how many hours or days worked. Just as we don't have a 9-to-5 policy, we don't need a vacation policy. It is always interesting to note how often the adjectives smart and simple describe the cleverest of innovations. Well, this is surely one of the simplest and smartest initiatives I have heard of in a long time, and I'm delighted to say that we have introduced this same non-policy at our parent company in both the UK and the US, where vacation policies can be particularly draconian. Assuming it goes as well as expected, we will encourage all our subsidiaries to follow suit, which will be incredibly exciting to watch. Living in a mobile cell. While the freedom to leave the office behind whenever and for as long as you want sounds incredibly appealing, this of course assumes that the office isn't going to simply follow you wherever you go on a 24/7 basis. For most modern-day salaried staff, there has never really been an 8-hour day or a 40-hour work week, but the advent of emails, texting, and smartphones has truly rendered them extinct and made the job of striking a healthy balance between home, family, and work even more challenging. Achieving that delicate balance was always something of a Chinese plate trick, but in recent years it has gone from a trick to a complex science. With almost everyone carrying their own personal telecommunications device every waking minute, the boundaries between work and private lives have all but disintegrated. By that, I mean that once upon a time, before BlackBerries, iPhones, and their kin changed all the rules, when people left the office, they would physically and mentally disengage from their colleagues, their desktop computer, their in-tray, and their office phones and intercoms. Not so anymore. The arrival of the smartphone, tablets, and laptop computers has meant that almost everyone these days simply puts the office in their pockets or purses and takes it along with them to lunch, to dinner, home for the night, the weekend, to the kids' football games, and yes, even to the beach, the ski slopes, or wherever they choose to holiday. Not only that, but the typical sender of a business-related email or text is usually blind to the time of day or day of the week. They expect, and usually will get, a response within a matter of hours, if not minutes. I have one very successful friend who is a senior partner in a big financial services firm, as well as being the mother of two young children. She became so perplexed by the never-ending volume of spurious weekend emails that she put a weekend auto-response message on her business email that says, "I am away from the office until Monday attending to my other full-time business, my family. If this message is about something that cannot wait, then I suggest you call or text me. Otherwise, I will get to it on Monday." If, like me, you have ever been on the receiving end of her message, you'll know who she is, but it seems the reaction has been terrific, and she hasn't had a single negative comment or any significant incidents of weekend business calls. In what could well be brewing as a second industrial revolution of sorts, the so-called BlackBerry suits have already started hitting the courts. In Chicago, a police sergeant filed a class action under the Fair Labor Standards Act against the city, claiming retroactive overtime compensation for all the hours he maintains he and his fellow officers are obliged to stay connected to their jobs via their police department-issued BlackBerries. As a lawyer representing the plaintiffs put it, they are hourly wage earners. If you're going to make people work when they're not on duty, you've got to pay them. At the time of writing, the case is ongoing, but it begs an intriguing question. Why shouldn't the same criteria apply to all workers, hourly or salaried, whose lives have become subjected to the new digital reality? The Chicago court's ruling is certainly going to be precedent-setting and could have a dramatic effect on the way all digitally enabled employees are compensated. Or it could possibly lead to a sudden fall-off in the number of company-mandated electronic communications devices. In the absence of widespread Netflix-like changes to the old workplace norms, it would seem only a matter of time before salaried employees also start to revolt. After all, their hours on the job have steadily increased from what may have averaged 50 hours a week in the traditional context of the workplace to the current ill-defined on-e-call 24/7 paradigm. Notwithstanding creative intercepts like my friend's auto-response, there's no turning back the clock. We all live in the world we live in, so the only way to mitigate the transition pain is to focus on quickly dumping outmoded policies that no longer fit our employees' business needs and private lifestyles. When they actually worked only 40 to 50 hours a week, then 4 weeks of paid vacation plus public holidays maybe made sense. Today, when our people are expected to work an immeasurable number of hours in their expanded virtual offices by being at the perpetual beck and call of their e-bosses, shouldn't the same approach apply to their time away from the bricks and mortar office? So, bravo Netflix and every other company that is taking bold steps to recalibrate the system. Just don't email me about it on the weekend and expect a response before Monday. There's no place like home. Another change to the old norms that has been driven by technology is the number of people who, like me, are now working from their homes. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, that number has risen by 41% in the last decade, with almost 15 million Americans working out of their homes. In the UK, the rise is less dramatic, but according to a labour force survey, is still up by 13% in the last 5 years. I am not sure if I was counted in this survey or not, but I am certainly the world's greatest advocate of doing it from the couch, or, more recently, from my hammock. I have not as yet been privy to any statistics on how home working plays into employee retention, but I can only imagine that it has to improve the ability to keep some employee groups happy, like telephone sales or service agents, but will have no relevance to more creative roles that require a lot of interaction with peers. This was certainly the reason Marissa Meyer, the CEO of Yahoo, gave when she caused a major kerfuffle by banning work from home. In defense of her decision, however, when speaking to a group of human resource professionals, she said, "While people are more productive when they're alone, they're more collaborative and innovative when they're together. Some of the best ideas come from pulling two different ideas together." As companies strive to cut costs, I foresee more and more administrative-type jobs being pushed out of expensive offices. One of the earlier adopters of work at home was the US airline JetBlue, which, when it started service in 2000, set up all of its telephone reservations agents as home-based employees in the Salt Lake City, Utah region. At the time, I remember founder David Neeleman proudly telling me that this initiative created several hundred new job openings for stay-at-home mothers who would be unable to work from a call center but could do a great job while the kids were at school or the baby was sleeping. Apparently, the turnover with this group has been negligible. I know a lot of "I'd go crazy if I had to stay around the house all week" types who find the very idea of working from home to be quite abhorrent. In my own case, I have always found working from home, as I have done all my life, reduces the stress levels I know I'd suffer if I were working from an office and bringing work home in the evenings and weekends. My family life and my work life have never had clear demarcation lines, but have always managed to coexist peacefully. Okay, I'll concede there have been a couple of times when the sheer volume of people that the business side of my life brought into the house became too much for my wife, but we've always managed to find a compromise and neutral ground. By being around the house, or houseboat as it was in the early days, so much, I got to see Holly and Sam as they grew up in a way that I could never have done, leaving for an office every morning and returning after they were in bed. And by osmosis, they too got an indirect education of sorts in how the business works. Now, when I am not continent hopping, as I do for almost 6 months a year, living on and working from Necker Island has taken the blending of home and business lives to new heights. We have the most incredible team of young people running the island and looking after our guests. Our philosophy at Virgin has always been to train our people well enough so they can leave, and treat them well enough so they don't want to. Needless to say, on a little piece of paradise like Necker, our retention levels are quite extraordinary.